Hello and welcome to this week's Investors Chronicle Alpha podcast. I am joined today by Algie Hall. Phil's taking a well-earned break this week. How are you doing, Algie?
Yeah, very well, thanks, John.
Excellent. Now, you are a regular contributor to the Alpha service. You handle the kind of stock screening and investment trust side of things. So I wanted to talk to you about those today and what you do and what we're seeing. Should we start with screens? So you do all the stock screening for the magazine through the weekly stock screening column, and we wanted to add something to Alpha around screening. So talk through what we put in place there.
Yeah, well, I want to be fair to James Norrington, who's the editor of Alpha, who actually I kind of devised the screens in my weekly column in the magazine, and picked a few of them, and James actually runs them and produces a bit of commentary on them for Alpha. But we kind of cherry picked some of the, you know, creme de la creme of the stock screens that I cover on a weekly basis, based around different themes. We have one based on momentum and earnings momentum and price momentum, which are a great complement to each other. We have one based on what's known as GARP, growth at a reasonable price. So it's looking for growth situations which look like they may be undervalued. Then we also have a screen that looks at reliable dividend payers. And importantly, it's not looking for high yields, which is often a really bad idea, because you just end up buying companies which are cheap for a reason. It's looking for companies which look like they're reliable dividend payers, which can really be an indication that a company has a very sound, strong business and that it holds its shareholders in high regard, and it's not wasting capital by plowing it back into growth projects or acquisitions, which may be slightly dubious. It's kind of returning some of that money to shareholders. And then the final one, based on stocks, that we look at is trying to identify quality companies, which obviously have been they're a type of investment that have done very well over a number of years. And that one doesn't look at price at all. It just is just focused on identifying quality mainly. And then there's a fifth screen, which is based on investment trusts. And it's a real passion of mine, this screen. And I started writing a column on it from July last year for Alpha. And the investment trust screen, basically, it's based on a very common sense approach, because it's only focused on two principles, both of which have historically proved to be very influential on future share price movements. And one is valuation, and the other is momentum, share price momentum.
The investment trust screen, there's a lot more commentary around that you write on a monthly basis. Just going back to the stock screens, you're also looking at those on a sort of a granular basis, market by market, so across the sort of market cap spectrum, as it were.
Yeah, we break out opportunities by it's basically by screening different index constituents. So it does mean we get some crossover with our large cap and small caps. But that often small caps are doing kind of look more attractive or less attractive on certain metrics just by virtue of the type of companies they are. So it makes sense to separate out the screening process. Also, some of the screens, we tweak them slightly. So for example, the small caps dividend screen is slightly different to the large cap dividend screen, because you're looking for kind of different characteristics and you're far more interested in kind of underlying growth and those kind of opportunities with small cap dividends than would be the case with large caps. So we think it makes sense to kind of look at different areas of the market with slightly different screens sometimes.
Okay, so how would you encourage readers of your stock screens, whether they be through the magazine or the Alpha service, how would you encourage readers to use these screens? What is the purpose of them?
Well, I mean, if anyone who reads the weekly column I do with any regularity would probably be bored with the phrase these screens are meant as ideas, the results from these screens meant for, as ideas from, for further research rather than off-the-shelf portfolios, which I write into pretty much every column nowadays. And that's really, the value of them is to generate ideas which may or may not, you know, live up to, you know, what the screen's trying to look for. And the only way you know whether an idea from a screen is living up to, you know, the objective is by going in and doing more research on that stock. I mean, screens are a wonderful way of, you know, kind of honing in on ideas which do look promising. They cannot do the whole job for you. So, I mean, I always emphasize that. They're a source for ideas which you may want to add to your, you know, portfolio. The other thing is, them not being a portfolio in and of themselves, it is incredibly hard for anyone to follow a screening process and just commit themselves to being entirely rule-based. And the reason for this is that when things go wrong, it just feels like you don't have any control. So you're so much more prone to be panicked out of your rule-based approach at times of stress than you would if you actually know and understand your holdings. And I think this is something when we talk about research and actually knowing your holdings, it's something which is actually very easily overlooked and that people don't talk about enough. That actually, you know, researching and understanding holdings is about reacting to at moments of stress. It's not about, it is about, you know, what you actually, the decisions you actually make. Of course, that's important. But it's the decisions that you're going to make in the future that are also incredibly important. So, you know, what do I do if the stock that I bought doubles? I mean, obviously, you know, there's the good advice that you should normally run your winners. But actually, that's a complete generalization. You're only going to know if that applies to your holding if you have a very good understanding of why you bought it in the first place and you've kind of set out your objectives, hopefully on paper, what you were expecting at that time. And then you know what to do. Then you'll have a far better chance of making the right decision or the decision that's right for you under those circumstances, and even more so if your stock has dropped in value by 50%, let's say, or something, you know, or some kind of very uncomfortable level of drop. You really need to understand, you know, what you're holding and why.
I mean, we have seen that sort of volatility over the last year. You know, we've seen, you know, obviously as coronavirus hit, you know, lots and lots of shares and indices fell quite sharply. We've seen some very strong recoveries since. I mean, you know, that sort of market stress that people sometimes react badly to is in abundance right now. I mean, what are you seeing through your stock screens, you know, that's telling you things about the market that perhaps it now is a good time to be, you know, very familiar with the stocks you hold and comfortable with why you're holding them?
I suppose there are a few things. I just before I answer that, I just want to give you an anecdote about my experience during March when the markets were crashing. Which was I decided to put together. Actually, it turned out to be very good timing. But you know, knowing that when markets crash like this, normally it's an opportunity to buy. I put together a stock screen based on buying shares which are as cheap as they have ever been, which was just trying to identify shares which have been sold down so hard that they were on a level or cheaper than where they were during the last crisis, from which everything kind of bounced back in the end. And I was writing this and I was trying to think about it, and I actually found myself in a complete stress head fog, just watching the markets collapsing around me and feeling this incredible searing pain across my chest, which I've never experienced before, which I can only attribute to stress. And so I had to write this almost in a state of disengagement, just because I was finding the whole experience so stressful, even though I knew the rational side of my brain had made me write this piece, and it was all about overcoming the emotion of you know, what the markets were throwing at us. But actually, even in writing it, I was being completely crushed by what was going on. what was going on in the real world. But fortunately, I did manage to write it, and maybe a few readers kind of read it and kind of like acted on it. Who knows? But I mean, hopefully they did, because it was like it turned out to be the most wonderful time to, you know, go into the market. And but it kind of felt like the most stressful and awful, you know, time to do anything because of what was going on. In terms of what you're asking about what I've been seeing recently, I suppose one of the interesting things is that kind of like a more traditional value-based approach has been doing extremely well. We're kind of finally seeing people often term a dash for trash, which is like the real market that the market thinks the recovery is coming. There was signs of it very early on last year that there was a dash for trash, but it totally petered out. I think that's very encouraging in some ways, because it suggests that the real economy may be due for, you know, a really strong recovery, as a lot of people have been talking about. You know, the fact that money in the market's getting behind that is encouraging.
It's not exactly backed up by the latest economic figures.
No. I mean, it's all in anticipation. I mean, until lockdown. I mean, you know, and there's obviously huge uncertainty. Until lockdown ends, who knows? And maybe, I mean, you know, and what people are hoping for is that there's a huge glut of savings and also kind of capital for companies to invest. These are the companies which have been doing better rather than the companies which have really suffered. There's a hope that there's a lot that's going to be unleashed. But I mean, until it happens, you know, we don't know whether it'll all transpire. But look to the evidence out there about things like savings rate and see there's a really good foundation to the argument. And also, you can just look down to the periods when lockdown did start to ease a bit. And, you know, you can see spending returning quite quickly. So I think, you know, there are reasons to be optimistic. And I mean, also when we're, you know, talking about this kind of resurgence in value that we've seen recently, you've also got to build in, you know, the particulars of the UK market and what's been happening in the UK recently especially with the end of Brexit, you know, the Brexit dealings. Obviously, you know, Brexit going to be with us, and like, you know, the further trade deals and whatever and the uncertainties, it's going to be with us for years and years and years and years, and if you thought it was all over, it ain't. But still, there's a feel-good factor to the fact that, you know, the main bit, the, you know, the big thing everyone was scared about has happened. The Brexit deal has been done, and then also the UK has been very successful with its vaccine rollout. Despite, you know, getting a lot of things wrong prior to that. And that means, you know, maybe we'll be coming out of lockdown fairly soon. Although, obviously, you know, new variants, et cetera, et cetera. There are uncertainties around that also. But I do think that's very interesting. And I mean, another interesting thing that I'm noticing from the screens is that they're getting better results at the moment. A lot of the problems I've found with the screens over the last few years is that the screens which look for quality in some way, and almost all the screens I run, you know, have it, you know, they have to build an element that searches for quality. They've thought they've seen quality, but they've actually just seen cyclicals which have been doing well for a number of years. So often, I think Phil Oakley often talks about quality traps. So, and there are lots out there where, at the end of a bull market, especially because, you know, these companies will appear to be, you know, really high margin, really high returns on capital employed, consistent growth. You know, they look great. They're just cyclicals in disguise. They often have huge fixed costs, which mean they see their profits tumble when sales go down. Which is something people call operational gearing. Those have been coming up in screens a lot. And I've written about this a lot in the weekly columns. But now there seem to be a lot more interesting companies coming through which display characteristics which suggest they do have a kind of genuine market advantage and some of them may be cyclicals, but they do also have a kind of a stronger growth story underpinning them. And a lot of those companies have seen their growth story actually improve during lockdown because they've been these kind of lockdown winners, as they've become termed. So in the stock screen I was writing last week, there was one called Clipper Logistics, which is a company which does a lot of e-fulfillment logistics work. And it's seen its business like take off over lockdown in a way that should kind of continue a kind of long-term growth trend going forward, or could do. You know, that would be, that's a bull argument. The screens have started to look quite a bit more interesting in terms of that output.
That's true, but there's also, I mean, there's also a feeling that markets are pretty frothy at the moment, particularly over in the US. You know, we have this so-called stonk phenomenon. You talked about a dash for trash, but the dash for trash took on a whole new form in the US with the GameStop saga. I mean, you know, when you talk about value, you know, are we talking about, you know, good companies that have had a little bit of a hard time, or are we talking about real trash? I get a bit confused by what people are calling value these days.
Yeah, no, I think it's confusing as well. And I mean, also there are a lot of reasons to question the fundamental basis on which we value companies. And we're publishing a feature that I've been writing, which will look in detail at, you know, why a lot of the traditional measures of value look really outdated at the moment. But yeah, no, I think I mean, you know, it's hard to say exactly what's going on in markets always. But with those kind of, with the game stonk and the stonk stocks or whatever we're calling them, I mean, and you know, in the UK, we saw companies like Cineworld and Pearson rising a lot, which is actually probably more to do with short covering.
Short covering, yeah, exactly.
But they're kind of like very specific. I know some people argue it's kind of like it could be a problem for the wider market. But I mean, in terms of the type of stocks being highlighted by stock screens, because they're not fishing in that really dirty, you know, the reason why you have quality filters on them is so, a lot of the time, especially if they're kind of value stock screens, the reason why you have quality filters is to try and keep it away from those kind of really dirty, heavily indebted, moribund kind of stocks. And so what you see through the lens of a stock screen often is something, you know, far more sensible ideas coming out rather than, like, you know, the really horrible stuff. I mean, there are a few stock screens which I run which intentionally try and go down to that dirty end of the market where you're, you know, trying to, you know, find stocks which are in a horrible state, but just doing a tiny bit better would justify a massive increase in the share price. But in generally, the stock screens kind of, you know, try and be sensible.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, one of the factors that you've already mentioned that we know has been a massive driver of share prices over the last couple of years is momentum. My worry about momentum is always that at some point it stops. And being in, you know, on the right side of things when momentum comes to an end is something that I've always struggled to understand how investors keep on top of. I mean, how do you see playing momentum? How do you think people should go about playing momentum? I mean, it can be dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with momentum is, you have to know what you're dealing with. It's normally best to kind of factor it into, factor it in with other kind of criteria. When momentum is basically hopping on a trend. It works best when it's a trend which kind of continues for a long time, and inevitably with those kind of trends that leads to overvaluation and some kind of peak and collapse. I mean, the collapse isn't inevitable in terms of how it happens, but it can feel quite crash-like. So you're dicing with that if you're if you go into momentum strategies all guns blazing, And it's a risk that, you're taking on. You have to know you're taking it on.
And that seems to be the big problem with what's going on in the US, that people are just buying instruments where the prices are going up because the prices are going up, and that is pretty much the end of the strategy. That feels like a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, if you get to really pivotal moments in markets, so for example, you know, the dot-com boom is something people have been drawing parallels with a lot, and I kind of find them fairly dubious, but not necessarily for the, you know, I find them dubious, but not necessarily in a way which contradicts the point you're making, actually, I should say. But
that's good.
If you look at what happened with them, then you basically, you had this herding into this kind of like, completely nonsensical, investment proposition that, you put .com after your name and, you're suddenly gold. And when momentum turned, then there was, it's just like it was catastrophic because there was one type of stock which had been doing all the running, and then that one type of stock suddenly completely tanked. I guess in terms of what we'd be looking at this time round, if we're saying momentum is dangerous, it'd be things like tech, clean energy, those kind of things which have really gone to the moon. Bitcoin, if you're playing that market, but in terms of the actual on the stock side, away from Bitcoin, a lot of the trends which we've seen are backed by huge amounts of growth and huge amounts of opportunities, which are tangible in those areas. So, there is the danger of sentiment turning and a lot of these stocks being really flattened, but it's perhaps not as senseless as Is it the comparison, would necessarily make it seem.
Maybe not universally. I think there may be pockets of senselessness, but...
And I think if you're playing those pockets, buyer beware. I mean, I think, if you're jumping aboard GameStop, I mean, regardless of what, the intention is behind these groups which are organising the buying of these stocks, you're essentially, because there isn't any fundamental value there in a game in the company, or there's not much. There's a crook, who's organizing it. I'm kind of thinking the Wolf of Wall Street boiler room type operation. So traditionally, there's a winner who's the person who's got everyone in, who then sells and then leaves everyone else to pick up the pieces. I don't know what the motivation is with the recent ones, but they're just a lot of losers with them, because if you keep on buying above the actual, what's fundamentally justified, what's a fundamentally justified value for that share by the actual company that has issued the share. If you keep on buying above that level, there's no support when the market falls. It's like no one wants those shares. It's like, they're bought on hype, and once the hype's gone, there's nothing left.
Mm. Well, thankfully, we tend to focus on a more sedentary end of the market. Perhaps one of the most sedentary ends, well, it hasn't been that sedentary over the past 12 months, is the world of investment trusts. Now, they are almost as old as the Investors Chronicle, but they are going strong. I think recently, Algy, you wrote something about a number of investment trusts that had doubled in value this year.
Yeah, we had an amazing year last year. A number did double in value.
Most of them from Baillie Gifford, I hasten to add.
I think it's Baillie Gifford, US Growth and Pacific Horizon, which Baillie Gifford also runs.
And Scottish Mortgage. Don't forget Scottish Mortgage.
I don't think Scottish Mortgage double.
Yeah,
anyway.
I think it did.
Probably.
I think it did. So I mean, these investment trusts, they are heavily exposed to those areas that we've said perhaps getting a bit frothy. Yeah. I mean, just let's rewind a little bit in the last 5 minutes. So you mentioned earlier you investment trust was your investment passion. Why is that? Why do you think they've proved so enduring and so adaptable? Particularly Baillie Gifford, to these new big trends.
I mean, I should say I started out writing about investment trusts kind of, almost 25 years ago, actually.
Hard to believe, Algy.
for a newsletter called the Investment Trust Newsletter, and I've kind of loved them ever since. I think they're just the perfect vehicle for active managers, basically. They shut out a lot of the influences which have been shown to make active managers underperform in open-ended funds, especially things like fund flows and the career risk due to very short-term judgments on what's going on. And they also provide oversight from a board, which, if done right, can be a real help to an active manager. So I think, they're just like this terrific vehicle for effectively insulating an active manager from pressures which mean that they're less likely to perform well and they're less likely to be truly active. They've also got certain kind of characteristics because they're funds which are set up as companies and which they can exploit, such as taking on debt to, buy shares in when times are exceptionally good and taking out hedges sometimes, if they've got, if the articles of association allow it, when times look bad. And then also what makes them really exciting, I think, for investors is that you have the discount which the shares trade at to the net asset value. This is a risk because sometimes those discounts can widen, and they do when markets crash, which is like makes them quite painful to hold through bad markets. But those discounts also narrow. So, for investors who really like them and look at them actively, looking at situations where a discount shows the potential to narrow can be really exciting and really profitable. And the column I write kind of uses that as one of its kickoff points in terms of highlighting investment trusts. So I think they're, they are excellent vehicles for active management. Also, they're popular, rightfully, in my opinion, with private investors and retail investors becoming a bigger and bigger proportion of the market. There's something else actually about them which is always really exciting, is that they're activist investors that get involved, and you can spot the activists quite easily from looking at the share registers. And the activists are people who buy investment trusts which they believe are on too wide a discount. Maybe they believe they're reasons for the underperformance of the trust which could be rectified, and they really get stuck in and they make change happen quite often, which can lead to quite substantial discount narrowing and performance improvements, sometimes changes in managers, things like that. And that is another layer of excitement which investment trust provides. So in terms of the report that I'm writing, those are all kind of factors which feed into my analysis of the trusts, which the screen that we use to identify promising trusts throws up.
So what are you looking for? What in this screen? What are we hoping to find out of this? What characteristics of trusts are we trying to pull out here?
We just look at the, in terms of the actual strategy. It looks for a discount that looks wide compared to the one year range of the discount premium valuation, and then it looks for strong 3 month share price momentum, and it's just ranking firms. It's ranking trusts on a combination of those two factors. So it couldn't be easier. There's also I also have some rules around how it selects 10 trusts, which are fairly boring, but work. But I mean, the thing is, because there's a readiness of data for analysing this from, I was very lucky that a broker called Winterflood Securities was kind enough to give me a lot of historic data, which I can match up with data from what's now called Refinitiv or Thomson Data Stream. I've been able to backtest the screen like really properly to see how well it works, and I'm going to give you figures from the last time we did an alpha report, which was the 18th of January, I think. But anyway, from 2004 to January, the system produced a cumulative total return based on annual reshuffles of 824%. And that compares with 208% from the FTSE All Share, which, you know, so it's come completely crushed the All Share. But obviously, we know the MSCI World Index did a lot better. But it only did 421%. So the MSCI World Index's total return was, only a tiny bit better than half the return from the system we're using to identify investment trusts in the Alpha report.
Shame these aren't off-the-shelf portfolios, Algie, because that is a tremendous performance.
Well, yeah, it is. But let me tell you, though, also, the drawdowns, have been painful when because you've got that discount widening aspect. The drawdowns from the strategy have been really painful when markets have crashed. So if you were using it as an off-the-shelf portfolio, then you do have the psychological issue that try holding it when, markets are down. If you look to the trust and you think, well, that one actually could have a place in my portfolio, and I do think there's a credible story there, I'm going to fit that in, in my portfolio that I'm comfortable with here. Then, if the markets do crash, you won't be stuck with 10 stocks and going, jeepers, what hang on here? Actually, do I even understand, how this strategy is working? This is like awful. I've been a fool. I'm going to sell it all, before the market suddenly shoots back up. So, you can look at whether it produces value by using this kind of analysis. But I say, do not be confused by that and what's going to go on in your own head if you try and just implement a stock screen for your own personal investments. It's gonna really mess with your mind. The value that those numbers give is that we're generating interesting ideas from this screen, and they're worth looking at. I would say, it's not, unless you could get someone to wrap it into a portfolio for you. And then have it as kind of like, it's something you didn't look at, then I'd say, you don't want to pay, attention to those figures in terms of thinking, right, I'm going to run this portfolio myself. Unless you're completely Spock-like in your approach to investing.
Well, Algie, we could always point readers and listeners in the direction of your big psychological piece from last year, Tame Your Brain. If you want to know how to manage your thought processes, that is the piece. Although, having said that, of course, these things can easily be written about and are much easier said than done.
It takes a bit of work to be a good,
to be a good Spock. Algie, that's been absolutely fantastic talking to you as usual. I'd encourage you all to go and read the last Alpha report, which is Best of British, am I right?
Yes, the last Alpha report was by British, I think we called it. And it was, in terms of what's been going on recently with takeovers and the renewed interest in UK companies, it seems to, obviously it's a very short space of time, so we can't judge it, but there was some prescience in what the screen was flashing up, at least, over the month, and actually the UK, it started to become a theme sometime last year, probably around October, and it coincided with the way the UK suddenly started to come back onto investors' radars. So the report does highlight interesting themes over and above what it does highlighting trusts.
Mm. Interesting you mentioned M&A there as a UK theme. We're seeing a flurry of UK companies being snapped up, something we're looking at in the magazine this week. I think you're right, the UK coming back in fashion. Who'd have thought it?
Right. Can you believe it?
Algie, brilliant speaking to you, and let's catch up again soon. And thank you everyone for listening. Thanks, Algie.
Thank you, a massive pleasure. Thanks, bye.
See you later.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.